long time, but I don't know how beneficial this is going to be.
Oh, well, I think that the work that you did do when you were still active is still very important, and we're I'm eager to to get that down in the record. So I think...
Well, do you want to briefly start with my college work, or...
Yeah, I think so. Let me start even earlier than that. You were born in 1902, I believe.
In 1902.
In Maryland. And
yes.
One, I would like to get to the University of Maryland years, but I'd like to know a little bit more about your childhood and the origins of your interest in science.
Well, my parents were married in 1899, and they lived on a farm near Hagerstown. They were what you might refer to in the South as sharecroppers. For instance, they gave half of the wheat and half of the corn that they got, and they could build up their implements and so on, and their livestock and everything like that off of their share of the crop. The man that owned the farm owned a larger farm. Now, this was only about 40 acres, and he owned a larger farm of roughly 200 acres. And he decided, after they had lived there and farmed for a while, that he wanted to change farms with them. And going to sort of a retirement. His son lived close to the place that he was going to move into, so my father changed farms with him and went onto the larger farm. This man, I was born on the first farm, and I was born in a log cabin. That was all that they had to live in while my father was there. It had one room log cabin, but in those days they built a brick house over the log cabin for warmth, you see. Mm-hmm. And that's what this man did. He moved with his son for a year, and built his brick house, which he wanted to retire in. Over the log cabin, and the log cabin still remains, but covered over with brick. The chimney's on the outside yet. I went by with my son just about 2 years ago, and we stopped a little bit there, and it's the same. So that my father farmed that for about 6 or 7 years, and then he went on to the larger farm for about 8 years. And then he had accumulated enough stock and machinery and so on so that he could buy his own farm. And he bought a farm in the middle of a Mennonite section. We happen to be another religion than that. And they were almost all of his neighbors were Mennonites. And I went to school for 2 years. It was a town called Morganville. It was only 1 mile south of the Mason-Dixon line. When my time came for high school, my father wanted me to be a farmer, and I didn't care so much for that. My mother wanted me to go on and get a little bit more education. So in those days, if you completed the eighth grade of your country school, you had the privilege of going in and taking the final exams of the first year of high school with the high school students. And if you passed, you could go on, you could miss the first year of high school and go on starting in the second year. Well, it so happens that when we got to the eighth grade, we only had three students left in the school. Another was a boy. He was about I would say about as capable as I was in things, but he wouldn't go in and take the exam. But he went to high school, and I passed the exam, and I missed the first year of high school. which made it a little difficult for me. When I took my sophomore year in high school, was well, it was the same as all of the other students. We had only had one type of lessons in high school. That is, we weren't divided into the academic and commercial at that time. Mm-hmm. In the junior year and the senior year, I took commercial in high school. I had no chemistry, and I had no physics when I went to college.
Really?
When I went down to the University of Maryland, my father took me down a few days before summer school was to start, to see about me entering there. He wanted me to go back to the farm, and my mother wanted me to continue on with schoolwork if I could get into the University of Maryland. The registrar at the University of Maryland was looking for students. It was the year after the war, year following the First World War. And he said that I should come to summer school. And that if I took a few of the courses which he would outline, one was in mathematics, another was in English. Mm-hmm. I took those and I got good grades in. I went around and asked him after the summer was finished, what about coming to regular college? He says, well, we'll overlook everything and you can come to college.
So this was 1919?
This was in 1919. And I had, as I was telling Dean Mortick out here before you came in, that in college, I decided first I was going to take chemical engineering. I don't know why I decided on that. And after the first year, I changed it to regular chemistry. But we had laboratories in those days. And in the general chemistry laboratory, I didn't know what a beaker was. I didn't know what a test tube was. I had to ask the man working next to me because he had it in high school. And I had nothing like that. So I brought to Dean Mortick, I brought a copy of my grades. Hmm. I don't know if you want to see that or
sure.
not after we finish.
Sure, that would be very interesting. Before you say more about your college years, when you grew up on the farm, had your parents had any experience with science? Were there any books around?
No, there was no experience. And when I went to high school, I forgot to mention this. I had to walk for 2 miles to get a train. Then I took a train for 4 miles. And then I walked another mile to high school. That's the conditions under which I went to high school for the 3 years I was in there.
That's well, you certainly got exercise.
And in the winter time, when there was snow, I had to leave at around 6:30 in the morning because the train left at 7:15. It was almost always on time. Mm. So I had to leave to be able to. Be there in time for it.
So you didn't have you hadn't had any. You said you hadn't had any science in high school. And had you been reading books or just had you?
No. The registrar wanted to know after I finished the summer school. He wanted to know what course I wanted to take. Well, at that time I thought chemical engineering would be as good as anything to sign up for.
And you don't remember why you thought that?
No. No, I have no idea as to the reason for that.
But so we're back in your chem lab, and you
in the chem lab. Then I took organic chemistry. Mm-hmm. I got very interested in organic chemistry. It was given in my junior year. I was told by someone that had taken it before. That was one of the hardest subjects that I would be subjected to. So I used the Norris book. I bought the Norris book, and I went completely through that during the summer.
Hmm.
So that when I went back, it was just like rolling off a log. That is organic chemistry. And the same way with laboratory. I got interested in the laboratory work. Then I took, we had a new organic chemistry teacher come in my senior year, and I took advanced organic chemistry there, which wasn't required of me.
Mm-hmm. Who were your teachers for organic chemistry?
That was Karesh from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
He came there, and he stayed the first year. When I worked on my master's degree, I had to take my master's degree in colloidal chemistry with Neil Gordon, because Karesh only had the one fellowship, and I needed a fellowship to get some money to go to school on, because I couldn't talk my parents into supporting me for more than undergraduate work.
Did you have brothers and sisters also?
I had two sisters, two younger sisters.
And did they go on to college?
No. The one died of cancer. She was about 35 or something like that when she died. The other went to high school.
But your parents did have other children to support. So
yes, they had others, and they were interested in making the farm produce as much as they could. So that I felt that after I finished undergraduate work, that it would be necessary for me to more or less support myself, and there was. No fellowships in organic chemistry. The man that had the fellowships in organic chemistry, his name was Ben Scher, and he got his doctor's degree after I had worked with Gordon for a year. And then there was available an opening for a fellowship for my second year of graduate work. And I did that with I took that with Karesh.
Did do you recall what texts and the sort of topics that Karesh had in the advanced organic course that you took with him?
No, we just have to look up in he went from one lecture to the next. He would vary his course. He would tell us to look up the so and so's work. Things of that nature, because we didn't have much of a library at the University of Maryland. See, University of Maryland, when I went there, we only had 350 students, and now it's around 60,000 or somewhere of that nature.
It's a little different, yeah.
And at the end of the year, Karesh told me that I had done enough work for my doctor's degree, but I'd have to take some academic courses, some physical chemistry and things like that. I said, oh, the hell with it. And so I never got my doctor's degree. He accepted my thesis. I wrote it up, and he accepted it and signed it, and the Penn State room up here has a copy of it, yes.
Was that the work that you published on organic radicals with him?
Yes, organic radicals.
Yeah, here's the, and also, I noticed there was another paper that you'd done with Gordon in,
that was on my master's degree, and the other one was on my doctor's degree. But then I went with the Naval Powder Factory. I was there for about 7 months. I went there, you see, jobs were a little bit hard to get in those days. And I went there with the idea that I could look around. I went out, Karesh suggested, made a few suggestions to me. One of them was to go out to Akron and to look around to, with the rubber companies. I remember going to Firestone and Goodrich at Akron, but I wasn't interested in that. Then I also went up to the Naugatuck Chemical Company in Connecticut, I think it is, and looked up there. But I looked at several places. Then
come in.
Oh, you're
there.
I'm here.
Here. So you went up to Naugatuck Chemical Company?
Yes, but I wasn't interested in any of those. And I had gotten married at the fore part of the summer. So that it was necessary for me to look around. My wife was a school teacher, and she stayed at her home then until I could get located down on Eastern Shore, Maryland. And we would meet in Marston occasionally.
Mm-hmm. What year was this that you got married?
25. Then, towards the end of the year, towards the end of 25, I heard that the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation was starting a laboratory up in Yonkers. And I wrote to them. And I was very disappointed when I went there, because it was nothing but an old garage that they were converting it into a laboratory. See, Ethyl Gas had just started their production, and they had just discovered that additives to gasoline would be helpful in preventing the knock. So,
was this laboratory at a production plant?
No, there was no production plant there. They found that there was a garage that was available. And they converted it into laboratories, the first floor. But down on the second floor, there was a few rooms on the second floor that they could enter into for steps that went down. And one of the sets of steps was back in the laboratory. They assigned me the laboratory clear at the end of the building. And the only reason that I was hired, I figured later out, the only reason I was hired was because of the fact that I had worked with Karesh on metallic organics.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see that we're using lead tetraethyl as an additive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I went there and my wife joined me a few days after I went up. I went with them on the 1st of February, 26.
Before we, I'd like to ask you some more about ethyl gasoline and the work you did there. What sort of work did you do at the Naval Powder Factory? That must have been in late 24, early 1925?
It was in 25, late 25. Oh, it was just analysis. It's just routine things. A chemist wasn't needed for the things that I did. No research of any kind. It was just merely a place for me. It was a place to look around. And I wasn't getting much money. $1,800 I was getting, which was a lot of money in those days.
Well, how much was your fellowship? Do you recall that?
With Karesh was able to get me $1,000 fellowship.
Mm-hmm. So it was the job in Naval Powder was a little bit more than that. But
yes,
still was. And another question that occurred to me was that were the rubber companies interested in the work on organic radicals as well? Is that why Karesh suggested that you go talk to them?
No, I don't think it was. They didn't seem they wanted me to work on rubber, and I wasn't interested in that. Well, at Ethyl Gas, the head of the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation was Graham Edgar, and he was a physical chemist that they got from University of Virginia. And I asked him what I was to work on after I got there, and to begin with, he raised my salary to $2,600.
Hmm.
And he said, metallic organics of some kind. Said whatever you want to. He said we'll run them downstairs. They set up a bunch of Delco motors with bouncing pins in them I think they had about a half dozen down there motors. They had two boys running those.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you.
Let me bring you the test.
Oh, all right. Thanks.
Oh, there's some right here. What?
I always go.
Okay. Thanks again. So you would make up a batch of a new metallic organic, and then they try it. They add it to the gasoline and try it in the test motor?
Yes.
I'll do that.
Oh, I was doing it the wrong way. Thank you. Well, I got acquainted with the boys downstairs. I was the organic chemist. They had, a physical chemist there. He was working on various gasolines and burning them and seeing what compounds he would get out of them.
Was that George Callinger?
No. George Callinger got the job at Ethelgas because of the fact that he published a book on metallic organics at MIT or someplace like that. He was a Belgian.
Hmm. So the physical chemist was someone else?
Yes. The physical chemist, his name was Rowan. I've never seen any publications of his.
So there were four chemists then. You, Graham Edgar, Callinger, and Rowan.
Yes. Well, eventually they got another fellow working on metallic organics from a fellow named Gamble from he was also from University of Maryland, but he was back of me several years back. Well, I went downstairs. I could hear the knocking of these motors running downstairs, and after I was there working on metallic organics for a period, well, maybe a month or something like that. One day, one of the boys said that we're having trouble down here. He said, "If we had something of a standard gasoline that wouldn't evaporate and change its properties, we could call that the standard. But if it evaporates a little bit, any gasoline that we have that evaporates a little bit." It changes the knocking in the motors by the volatile material going off. Well, I told him, I asked them, how about making a hydrocarbon that would have a constant boiling? And they said, good. So I made some normal heptane. And the boys, I made about a quart or something like that, or about a liter, it knocked so badly that it blew the bouncing pin out of the Delco motor that they were using. So I told him I would try making another one. And the easiest one that I could make was an octane that melted, that boiled about the same temperature as the heptane did. They ran that in the motor, and gosh, they got no knock at all. So I decided then that I had the problem solved. That the heptanes, because it had an odd number of carbon atoms, knocked. And the octane, having an even number, didn't knock at all until I made normal octane. And that knocked as bad as the heptane. Then, right away, on the first two compounds that I made, we made the standard testing gas. But by mixing together in different portions, that is 90 octane or 92 octane or whatever it is, because they both boil at approximately the same temperature.
So did you continue work and find out?
Then I continued on. I made all of the heptanes, and about two-thirds of octanes. I was working on octanes when I quit. And towards the fall of the second year, oh, I got a raise to $3,200 there at the end of the, at the end of the first year. And towards the fall of the second year, I had a visitor that came up. He said that he had some business in New York, but I was working on heptanes, and he wanted to find out about heptanes. It was Frank Whitmore, who eventually became dean of the school here at Penn State. And he stayed about a half a day in my lab. He wanted to know what everything was, what I was doing now. And so I went over everything with him. I had about a half dozen Grignards there in 5-liter flasks going at the same time. And he was quite impressed about what I was doing. And when he left, he said, "You know, if you're ever looking for a job, let me know." So that came in later on. That was the reason that I came to Penn State then. So
had he known your work from the literature, or
no? I had never published anything, but he had heard that I was working on hydrocarbon, and he was very interested in hydrocarbon, because after I had been at Rockefeller Institute and came over here, I found that almost all of his laboratory work was on hydrocarbons. Well, he called me then on the phone a little bit later on. A few weeks later or something like that. And there was an organic symposium out at Columbus, Ohio. And he was wondering whether I was going to Columbus. And if I was, whether I would bring along a hydrocarbon, a small amount in a test tube or something. So I asked Edgar whether I could go out to this meeting in Ohio that Whitmore suggested I come out to it. And Edgar said, "Sure, go ahead." Well, one of Whitmore's friends was at the meeting, Conant of Harvard. And Conant had been trying to produce hexamethylethane. Hexamethylethane is a product that boils at 108 and it melts at 105. There's only 3 degrees difference in the boiling and the melting point. So when Whitmore came up, I showed him. I had a distilling flask there. I think about 500 grams or something like that in it. And I started, and he told me that his friend at Harvard was trying to get his hands on some of it. He had some students working on it up there, and he wasn't ever able to produce any quantity more than about a gram or something like that. So Whitmore asked whether at this Columbus meeting whether I brought the material along, and I told him yes, and I pulled it out of the pocket, a test tube of it. He said, "Well, we'll have dinner together." And we had I had dinner with Conant and Whitmore and some others at there was a table of eight around there. So Whitmore asked me to give him this material, and he said, he asked Conant, "Well, did you ever see this amount of hexamethylethane before?" And Conant was greatly surprised. Well, I went back to Ethyl Gasoline Corporation. And shortly after I got back, I got a letter from P.A. Levine of Rockefeller Institute. I never heard of Rockefeller Institute before, and I never heard of P.A. Levine. And he asked me, he said that they were having trouble making a certain compound. And he was wondering whether I could make the compound for him.
Excuse me 1 second. So you...
I took the letter in and I showed it to Graham Edgar. Edgar asked me whether I thought I could make it. And I told him, oh yes, there wouldn't be any trouble at all in making. Well, he said, how long would it take you? I told him, maybe a couple of weeks. I asked him whether I could do it in the night then. He said, oh no, he said, we'll give it to them as a present. If you want to make it up for them. So I made it up, or rather I called Dr. Levine on the phone, and I told him that I could make it, and the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation said that I could make it there with them. So he said, go ahead and make it. And they insisted on paying for it, but anyway, it ended up at it was a gift for them. Well, I called him up one day and told him that I had completed the work, and I asked him whether the Rockefeller Institute was open in the evening, that I could deliver it in the evening, otherwise it would take me a whole day to go down to New York and to come back. He said, no, everything is closed up at Rockefeller Institute in the evening, and that there's no one working there in the evening. He said, how about bringing it around to my home and having dinner with me? So I went around, and he and his wife had an apartment in not very far from where Simon Flexner lived. He was the head of the Rockefeller Institute. So I delivered it to him, and we had quite a talk that evening. And he called me up in a few days later and asked whether I could have dinner with him at Rockefeller Institute, with he and Dr. Flexner. And he said he would like to show me the Institute. Well, I went down in the morning. I'd never been there before, and I told Edgar that I was going down, and that I didn't know what they wanted to what it was all about or anything at all like that. Well, anyway, after showing me around the Institute, he wanted to know, he said it was about lunchtime, he said he's made arrangements that we would have dinner with Simon Flexner in a private dining room that which had beside of his office. Flexner was the first head of the Rockefeller, it was Rockefeller Institute in those days, but it's changed to Rockefeller University now. Well, I had, during the course of the dinner, Flexner asked me whether I would consider coming to Rockefeller Institute to work, which was a great surprise to me. And he said, if you would think about it, he said, we've talked it over. Of getting an organic chemist here with the medical. See, Levine's work. Levine was an organic chemist, but yet he was doing medical work. He did his work with quite a bit of his work. He was doing research with Emil Fischer in Germany, who worked on sugars, and there he met Landsteiner. Landsteiner got his degree in Vienna, got his doctor's degree, and then he went to Emil Fischer in 1891, and he worked for 4 or 5 years with Fischer, and there he met Levine. Well, Flexner told me that they would raise my pay to $4,000 a year.
Sounds pretty good.
Which was, it was before the raises had come out for ethyl gas, but after I went back and told Edgar that I was going to ethyl gasoline, he wanted to know how much they were paying me, and he said, we were going to raise your pay to that coming the 1st of January. Anyway, Flexner told me that I would be working for Levine and anyone else that wanted any compounds. But Levine then in the afternoon when I went with him, he said that the work would be primarily with he and with Landsteiner. And he said occasionally you would be working for making a compound or so for someone else, because that was the arrangement that we that you came here under. Well, Flexner, in making the offer, he said, "Well, you know, we closed down in the summer." He said, "You'll have 2 months vacation." And so I accepted right away, without going back and consulting Edgar or the ones back at Ethel Gaius.
Was this in 1928 or?
That was in 28. And I had a few things that I wanted to finish at Ethel Gaius, so I told them that I would come down there the 1st of February in 1928. Mm-hmm. And Levine, when he took me around showing me things, he showed me a room. Oh, it was about 1.5 times as big as this room that I would have for a laboratory. They were using it for storage at that time, and he said that would be. But in the meantime, I would be working upstairs, where he had his he had a number of dogs upstairs that he was working on. Giving him ribonucleic acid and various other things.
So your job was to be the organic chemist of the team, and
was the organic chemist. And when I went downstairs, from February until I was supposed to have my vacation of 2 months then. But I stayed and worked on compounds all during the summer there, and then when September started, I was to move out into my laboratory, which had been just arranged for me, and I was to have a fellow to work full time with me to wash glasses or to do any little jobs that I would have for him to do. Well. Quite a number of people that were in the institute wanted to have compounds made for them. So, Levine would come back when they would want a compound. He said, "Will that take much of your time?" And I would tell him about how much time I thought it would take. He says, "Well," he said, "we'll have him cancel or put it off or something like that. But otherwise." A few of them, I made a few of the compounds, but I was working mainly for Levine, and he was a good friend of Landsteiner, and anything that Landsteiner wanted, Levine would let me go ahead on.
Who were some of the other faculty members of the Institute then?
Roten?
Mm-hmm.
I worked with Roten before I left. Raymond,
did you have any contact with Van Slyke? Was he still there? Or?
Van Slyke. He's the fellow that worked on human hearts,
mm-hmm.
For a while, and he would show me the tissue that he had to trim it off. You see, every once in a while, I would go around. We would have dinner together. You see, they had a big lunch room. Which we would all grin. Everyone on the faculty would grin and have lunch there. And some of them that, if you weren't on the regular faculty of Rockefeller Institute, you couldn't eat there. You had to bring your own lunch and eat a bag or go out for lunch or something like that. Which the boy that was working for me had to do that, and. The first summer I worked on products for different people there, mm-hmm. to get the feel of things. The second summer I made some compounds, and I started doing some research on the Walden inversion. And when Levine came back, I worked all summer the second summer. And when Levine came back, I had this written up, the first paper written up. And I took the paper to Levine, and I showed it to Levine. And Levine said, "I didn't know you could do things like that." He said, "Well, would you want to continue?" And I said, well, how about making compounds for the other people? He said, well, could you do those on the side? Well, it ended up that he gave me, I had a Jap for a year or two, I had a German for a year or two. They were just making compounds, you see. If anyone would want a compound, they would be making it, but under my direction, though. So I would have to see. But my main work was on the Walden inversion for them. I worked on that for about 5 years.
What first got you interested in that? Do you recall why you started working on the Walden?
I didn't want to be making compounds for others because that was the principal part of the research, yeah. Was to make the compounds, and then all they had to do was to give them to animals or some or whatever it was, and record the results that they would get on it.
So
Levine and I, we published, oh, I think it was 32 papers or something like that, all together. I had to write up a few after I left and came here. Well, at just about that time, in early 34, there had been quite a bit of work on hormones, and it was mainly by the Germans that were working on hormones. And when we would finish our lunch, we would all head back to the library to see the journals that would come in. If there was a journal that came in that we would that would have an article in that it would be interested in, well, we would read that and then come back to do the work. But in the meantime, the boys were taking care of anything that we had, distillations or anything like that we had going. Well, I got interested in hormones, and I wanted to. I thought there would be a big demand for hormones eventually. I went to Levine about it, and Levine asked me what I wanted, what I thought they could be made from. I said from vegetable material. He said, "Well, Dr. Jacobs, who was in the pharmacology department here, has worked and proven definitely that." Hormones cannot be made from saponins. He worked on the saponin that he gets from sarsaparilla root.
Mm-hmm. And he proved that you couldn't make.
He proved definitely. Yeah. Well, I told him that I wanted to work on those regardless of what was proven here at the institute. So Levine then he got quite excited and. He came back then about half an hour or so later, and he said, "I have an appointment with Dr. Flexter. The two of us are going down to see Dr. Flexter. Dr. Flexter wanted to know why I wanted to work on hormones." And he said, my work was satisfactory there. I told him that I just got the idea that I wanted to work on hormones, that's a practical thing to work on. And that if I couldn't work on them at Rockefeller Institute, I would find a place to work on them. Oh, Flexter got mad. He hit the table, and he said, "No one leaves the Rockefeller Institute if their work is satisfactory." And he said, "Your work is satisfactory here, and you're going to work with Dr. Levine or whatever he says." And so I said, "All right, if that's your attitude, why I'll find some place to work on home." So I wrote to Whitmore. And I said to Whitmore in my letter, I said, "Do you remember that you asked me if I was ever ready to change jobs to let you know?" Well, I told him I was ready to work on hormones, and they won't let me work on hormones at Rockefeller Institute. And do you have a job? He asked me to come over and see him.
And before we get to Penn State, though, I wanted to ask you a few more questions about the Rockefeller, but why not go ahead and finish that thought? That you wrote to Whitmore and then went to see him. And
well, I spent a day with Whitmore here. Well, I spent almost all the second day too.
Mm-hmm.
And Whitmore told me that the only this was in probably in May. He said that the only thing that hadn't been signed up for was he could give me a fellowship, and that only paid $1,800.
Hmm.
He said, "Can you live on it?" I told him I would try. He said, "All right, if you want to come for that." And I have here a copy of where is it? My first appointment by Dr. Flexner, or Dr. Hetzel here, showing that I got $1,800.
Hmm.
And I was getting 40, they had raised my pay at the Rockefeller Institute, I was getting $4,400 at the Rockefeller Institute then. And while I have it here, I'll show you. This is what I had when I left here after being here for 8 years. I got up to 3,400 or something like that here.
3,480. Yeah. So it took.
And I was a full professor here too.
Well, what I wanted to just ask you a little bit more about the context in which you got interested in hormones, because it. That was a period when, as you said, there was a lot of interesting work going on in Europe about
It was only work, except there was some work by Doisy out at St. Louis. Doisy was working on estrone and estradiol.
Mm-hmm. Was anyone at the Rockefeller following that aside from, well, Jacobs must have been following
it. No, Jacobs had discontinued about a year before that.
And Levine, as you said, wasn't very interested.
No, Levine he wanted me to continue on with with the Mullen inversion.
Mm-hmm. And how, were you just picking up Berichte and the other?
I was just picking up the German journals and following what they were doing in Germany. Ruzicka was a big worker, and Butenandt was just a young fella. I went to Germany in 38, a year before the war. I went over on the Queen Mary, and who should I meet on there? And we had dinner with every meal going over, but Butz and his wife. He was just married. You know, Butz was Secretary of Agriculture.
No kidding.
Eventually, he became Secretary of Agriculture. He was working at Beltsville at that time.
Oh, that's an interesting coincidence.
But I went over with the idea of seeing Butenandt, and I went to Berlin to see Butenandt. I had an appointment with Butenandt because he had been working on hormones. I got to Berlin on a Saturday night. And I waited on Sunday. I went down to Potsdam to see where the old German emperors used to have the castles down at Potsdam, things like that. And then I called Monday morning. I called Butenandt's office. They wouldn't see me.
Hmm.
But I think it was because of the fact that on Saturday night, near the hotel that I was staying in, I was looking at what was advertised as a nightclub, and a young fellow came up beside me, and he said, "Are you English?" I told him, "No, I was American." And he said, "Are you? Do you want to?" He said, "They have a good show there. Do you want to go to it tonight?" I said, "Well, if it's a good show and I can get a good meal there, why I may consider it." He said, "Well." Could I join you? He said, "I'll go home if I can. I'll go home and get my wife." Well, the next day, they're the ones that wanted me to go to Potsdam with them the next day. But when the bill came, they wanted to pay the bill up there, and she said, "You know, if it hadn't been for you, that is, his wife said this, if it hadn't been for you, we couldn't come here. He said, we're Jewish. Hmm. And so I went to Potsdam the next day with them. She prepared a nice chicken dinner. We had lunch down there and everything like that. But apparently the word got around that that I was associated with some Jewish friends there.
Hmm.
But I called up and I couldn't get my appointment confirmed with Buden. But I'm saying him, Schering has invited me to come to Berlin the 22nd of May. They're putting on what they call the Russell Marker Symposium over there, and Buden is coming to that. So Buhnert is a few years younger than I am, and he's living in Munich at the present time. So I'll get to meet him, and
so finally have the appointment.
Yes.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah. Well, by that time, of course, you had already published several papers. On
yes, I had published a number of papers. See, this was in 38.
So, you know, I'm sure by then you were getting quite a reputation in Europe, since that's where most of the work was still going on.
I've got several letters. I've corresponded with Rizika after I left here, even, and he's told me any time you're in Zurich, I want you to come to see me. But I kept putting it off. I've been to Zurich several times, and I kept putting off seeing him because he was working, and I retired at in 49. I just decided that I had put hormones into production in Mexico, and there was that's what I came to Mexico for, and I was going to retire. Then I went into silver and various other things.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that I hope at the end. Let me just go back to when you came to Penn State then. One other question that occurred to me was 38 your first trip to Europe?
That was my first trip to Europe. It was my only trip to Europe until after I retired. Mm-hmm. Then I went to Europe quite regularly. And my wife, she counted up the times that she'd been. She'd been there 12 times. And we would stay only twice of those 12 times that my wife had been there we stayed only for about 3 weeks or something like that, but otherwise we would stay for the whole summer. That is, 2 to 3 months we would stay.
In 38, did you see any other chemists, or was Buhnert the only one you had tried?
I went to Pasteur Institute. There was a friend of mine his name was Steiger. He was at Rockefeller Institute, and he went to Pasteur Institute. I went to Pasteur Institute in Paris. Then I went to Berlin. Then I went over to Copenhagen. Then I went up to Norway. I stayed a few days in Oslo, just killing time because I had my reservations to come back. And then I went over to Bergen. And I took a boat across the North Sea, and then I went down to England, and then I came back here to Penn State. I stayed about 2 to 3 weeks in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you got to Penn State in 1934 then, and started, I gather you just started working, set up your own lab, and started...
Well, I came here, I was very disappointed. I came here, and the only thing that they could find that I could work on was about a kilo of very dirty cholesterol. And that's the only thing that was in the storeroom for me to work on. So I spent more than a year just repeating work that the Germans had done.
Was this mainly Buhnert and Rizik's
work? Buhnert and Rizik and... there was a few other people, Chechi and Hagdorn. They were working on saponins. They decided on the wrong structure for the side chain of the saponins. And Fieser agreed with him. They said that was correct.
Yeah, that was Fieser and Jacobson.
Fieser, you're familiar with everything.
Well, I told you, I've been reading a lot of the old papers. It's well, let me just to, if you could think back to the way the techniques that were being used then in the mid-1930s, and there are two questions I have. One was, how did the equipment and the help that you had at Penn State compare to the Rockefeller and to Ethyl Gas, first? And second, what were some of the techniques that you were using in the mid-30s?
Well, when I first came to Penn State, there were some pretty good glass blowers around that if we wanted some equipment, well, we could have it made. But chemicals and things like that, why, I had to wait until the second year. Then Park Davis would buy things after I became affiliated with Park Davis. You see, when I went to Europe, I had my first major thing was in the bag. It was the getting of pregnenediol from bull's urine. Mm-hmm. And it was because of that that the president of Park Davis decided that Mexico wouldn't be the place to produce. After I showed him that hormones could be made from Cabeza Negro, he says, oh, we'll run a stable of bulls in, like we have horses here, and we'll get the urine from that. And because I made them 35 grams, and they thought that was an awful lot of progesterone.
Yeah, but that must have it must have taken how many gallons of bull's urine to get that?
That first 35 grams that I made wasn't from bull's urine. That was from human pregnancy urine, mm-hmm. which they had been getting estradiol from that, and they had been saving the fractions that what they call the neutral fraction. And I worked up the neutral fraction here, and I got enough pregnenediol out of that to see there was a lot of allopregnenediol with it, and after separating the allo out, I got enough pregnenediol to make 35 grams of pure progesterone, and they thought that was an awful lot of material of that hormone in those days, but now they make it by the ton.
Well, things have changed largely as a result of the work that you did in the 40s. Go ahead.
No. I don't want to interrupt.
Well, let me get the tape ending. So let me.
But Whitman published the book. He's a medical doctor, and it's on medicine. But this portion in here deals. He came to Mexico. He was a couple days in Mexico, and I gave him the idea or this portion of it here, and where is it? And a small picture which I had. Here's the picture. But only this portion of his book deals with me. The rest of it is on the subject there, of the whole book. It's in German, and they have it over in the library. I gave it to the library here, the German book. Now, here, you don't have your tape running then.
Oh, yeah, I do, but that's okay.
Here's another one that's written in Dutch. This is the second company. When I left Syntex, I started another company called Botanica Max, and at the I had so much trouble there with the other people from Syntex that some people in Mexico said they would take it over, but they would change the name of it to Hormasen, and then Smith, Klein, and French bought. After I left in 49, Smith, Klein, and French bought Hormasynth from them, and they changed the name to Diosynth. Then Organon bought Diosynth from Smith, Kline, and French, and they're one of the producers at the present time of hormone in Mexico.
So the Organon was one of the European cartel that...
Yeah, it's one of the Europeans, yes.
But your work had helped to break the cartel.
Yes,
here's
a picture, and this is published in Dutch, but Task said that he was going to publish it in book form later on with the whole hormone industry.
Yeah, that's very good. I hope maybe later I can get some copies of those so I can
all right.
Put those to the file. You were just starting to talk about the work that you did with Craig Dial and some of the other early syntheses. There were good glass blowers here, you had said, but presumably you didn't have the kind of help you had at the Rockefeller, where you had a group of assistants who would do this.
I looked up, you see, I would generally get boys that were working on their doctor's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally I would get someone that had the doctor's degree of Whitmore's men and use them for they wanted to experience additional experience on the type of work that I was doing, and occasionally Whitmore would come to me and tell me that he had a man that wants an extra year of work with you. So that there was 32 or 33 different ones that I worked with in the time that I was here. And only one of those that was not working on the doctor. I had several came in here and worked on the doctor's degree, full-time on the doctor's degree. One was Turner. Turner was caught in the war. Turner was working with Bunnant. He was a Canadian, and the war started, and being a Canadian, he couldn't. You see, that was before we got into the war, so he came down here, and I saw him back of me in the laboratory. He said, "I'm working for you," and so he told me then later on who he was working for over there, and in Europe, and. He got his doctor's degree with me, and he went to Philadelphia to work then. But there's only one outsider that already had his doctor's degree that I wanted to come here, and he, you see, on these hormones, there's two classes of two different groups of hormones that can be made from these materials. Syntax. Has written up an article in a publication which they make available only to workers of Syntax. But they sent me a copy of it for some reason or other, and I just got that this week. And one of them is a progesterone type. The cortisone type would come under the progesterone because they have the same number of carbon atoms in both of them. Now Upjohn, when I was about ready to leave go into retirement, Upjohn wanted me to come to see them about. They had the idea that that they wanted to use pregnidine alone as a starting material for the products that they would be interested in. They were getting the enzymes out of the adrenal glands,
mm-hmm.
and oxidizing with the enzyme to put on in the 12 position.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other type of compound was the male and the female hormone. Now the male hormone. There's two of them. There's androsterone and there's testosterone. Of the and that has two less carbon atoms in it. And the female hormone is the same. The female has a benzene ring. The first ring is a benzene ring.
Mm-hmm.
And estrone and estradiol are the two female hormones which they get, and both of those have two less carbon atoms than the progesterone. So I was interested in a fellow named Kruger was working at Virginia on the Beckman rearrangement, and I was interested in applying the Beckman rearrangement to a product that we were getting from. I had him to come here and work on a product that we were getting from sarsaparilla root, but because it didn't have extra double bond in to interfere with it, but he was able to knock that off by the Beckman rearrangement down to what to water, and at the present day they're still using the same process. And I applied it then to the Dallas Channel.
That was in
about 39 or somewhere around there. Yes, it would be 39.
Well, when that's one of the sorts of things that I had in mind when I was asking about techniques we're using, applying the Beckman rearrangement, for instance.
I talked to Flores as vice president and in charge of Cyril's work in Mexico. And by the way, Monsanto has taken over Cyril, and the man from Syntex in Germany, he was here. He's been here a few times. He told me that Cyril has discontinued production. They were one of the big producers in Mexico. He said that that they and SIBA have both discontinued, and they've decided to buy the hormones from the ones that are producing. You see, they're all very friendly on making the hormone. One will make one product, another will make another product, and so on like that. And then if the one needs a product that the other is making, why they'll exchange products. And they've been doing that for years. And all of the processes which they're using in Mexico at the present time, Dr. Flores told me this. He said they're using essentially the processes which I took to Mexico. And when I went to Mexico, there were no chemists in Mexico, and there was no equipment. I spent almost a year getting the equipment and the chemicals that we needed. That is, before we got started with Syntex. I was here at that time.
Did you send them down from Penn State to Mexico? Or?
No. I would tell them what to order, and they ordered it.
I can imagine that was a problem in the early days.
So I went to Mexico quite often in those days because I was working on a lot of plants that grew in Mexico. And one of the things that I was working on in Mexico, working on the various saponins, I wanted to get all of the Dioscorea, the different Dioscoreas that I could find in Mexico. Even though I could get only a small amount of some of them, and some of them would have practically nothing in, I got, I think, 20-some Dioscoreas that are collected in various parts of Mexico. And one of them was called Barbasco root by the natives. That's the one that's used at the present time, and that had almost pure diosgenin that I would get from that, in contrast with the Cabeza Negro, which had quite a lot of other products there. But I couldn't use that because I found it at a place called Tierra Blanca, and the only way that you could get the product out of there during the war was to put it on a boat and take it over to Veracruz and then bring it in from Veracruz. I didn't want to do that, so I started on Cabeza Negro when I first went to Mexico. Then when I broke off with Syntex and went on my own on Botanica Botanica Max. I started immediately on this Barbasco route.
Well, I do want to get back into some of that and ask you about your research for that syntax and after with Botanica Max. But I still had a couple of questions about the early years at Penn State. One thing was, how did the other organic chemists in the U.S. who were working on steroids react to, for instance, when you came up with the right structure for the side chain
on sarsaparilla from sarsaparilla root.
How did people react? Did you have contact with Fieser and the others?
Yes. Fieser, up until that time, was refereeing all of my papers that I sent in, and I think I had 40 or something like that on steroids. And Arthur Lamb, who was editor of the Journal of Chemical Education, he was at Harvard also. And I sent this paper in with Warman on showing that Fieser was wrong on agreeing with the Germans that the side chain was inert, because in this paper we pointed out that there were so many typical reactions, especially that you could use acetic anhydride at 200 degrees. But no one ever thought of using it at 200 degrees until we did one day and over there, and it worked. It opened up the side chain. And that all of the reactions that we had couldn't be explained on except for this formula. And so Lamb got in touch with me, and he said, "Can you come over to Harvard?" So I went over, and Fieser and Mary, his wife, they both invited me to dinner in the night. Well, Fieser thought that I was going to agree to with him that this formula was wrong, that we were proposing. But Fieser got so mad during the day that he let his wife take me to dinner, and he wouldn't show up.
Oh,
really? But Lamb published it. Lamb told me that he didn't know anything about it, but he said that if I was so convinced that I was correct, he would publish it. And he published it. And I didn't go to this meeting. There was a meeting in Richmond, an organic symposium, and Fieser gave a paper on the saponins, and he gave his formula, and he said others disagree with me. I was told that.
That was just about the time.
Yeah, that was just about the time the paper was being published.
Well, it'd be interesting to look up Fieser's paper on the.
I know. In his books, his book is not very complimentary to me.
Well,
he said sometimes I go to work and no one knows whether I'm coming back the next day.
finally, in the later editions of his book on the steroids, they certainly did talk about that piece of work that you and Norman had done. And,
mm-hmm.
Obviously, they had to accept the structure finally. So, was that the only contact you had with Fieser?
That was the only time that I saw Fieser.
Yeah. That was what became known as the marker degradation.
Yes.
Using acetic anhydride at that.
Mm-hmm.
At that
yes, and they tell me that they're still using that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're using an awful lot. I was surprised when I went to Mexico, and I asked several whether I even went to Syntex, where they're producing down at Puerto Vaca, and I mean they're just producing and then sending the product to the United States or wherever they want to send it to, Indications are that they were collecting between 75,000 tons of root a year, and that's all brought out of the jungles for these natives on their back. So some of it is dried in the little villages, driving, and they chop it up, you see, and dry it in the sun. There. Others is dried at the coffee drying places and things like that. But now at the present time, starting back about 1974, the Mexican government has taken over the collection of all root in Mexico. They won't let these various companies collect their own root anymore. And then they'll sell it to these companies, what they want. But Flores told me, and everyone told me there, they indicated that there was between 75,000 tons and 80,000 tons of raw root a year that was brought out by the Navy. And that was 12 years ago. So I don't know what's brought out at the present time.
It's a remarkable woman.
they tried to put it under cultivation, but they would have to let it grow for at least 4 years.
Yeah, that creates problems, doesn't it? Well,
these roots, they get to be the Barbasco. They showed me some of the Barbasco. They're huge roots, and they get rings in them. Just like a tree stump, so that you can count the number of years, you know. And they've told me that some of them are as much as 250 to 300 years, and they will weigh as much as 250 kilos, something like that.
I wanted to, speaking of Barbasco root and the others, I wanted to go back to the mid-30s again and ask you how you got on to Dioscorias and all the various other plant species that you began looking at. Did botanists come to you with the idea that you might be able to look for those?
No.
Or did you just have the idea yourself that...
You see, I never had a course in botany in my life in school. So I went over to the botany department someplace. Oh gosh, I forget what his name was. Anyway, the botanist, the head of the botany department, came out, and he had a talk with me. And he said, "You're the fellow that's going around collecting all of these roots." He said, "Why don't you? We're botanists here. Why don't you let us do it?" And so that's the last that I had to do with with him. I told him that I was well satisfied with what I was collecting. But anyway, I got some material from Japan. They published, some Japanese published a paper on what they thought might be a saponin that had a double bond in it. And they called it diosgenin. So, they sent me a small sample of it, very crude material. I purified the stuff up, and I worked it up to progesterone from that. So then, I thought that was going to be a material that would be commercially of interest. So I decided that I'd better try to find a source of it. Pennington Company in New York sell various products to be extracted for drugs and things of that nature. And they had one of the products in there, besides they had Smilax and a few other things in there, which would give the sarsaparilla type of compound. But they had one of the products in there that they had available was Bethroot. But they only had a small amount of that. I got that, and sure enough, that had diosgenin in. And very good product I got out of that. I found out where they got the product. They got it from North Carolina. I went to North Carolina, and the roots are only about the size of your thumb. And if you collected say 100 pounds in a year's time, that may you may have the limit there of what you could get. So I decided that wasn't the thing. So I went to California, Texas, Arizona, various other places, looking for plant material, and I was looking for Dioscorea. I generally had graduate students going with me, or retired botanists. In Texas, I went to Texas A&M College, and they told me that there were two retired botanists. One, they lived at different places, apart from each other. One was interested in bees, another, I forget what he was interested in. Well, I called them on the phone, and one lived on one side of San Antonio, on one on the other side. And so I picked up the one that lived nearest to San Antonio. And he knew quite well the other one, and so he furnished the truck. And while I was sitting there in the evening, he invited us to stay overnight at his home. While we were sitting there, he had an old botany book. And I looked up Dioscorea in the botany book, and it had a picture of a big one. They said that it grew in Mexico. It grew between Orizaba and Cordoba along a stream of water. So I thought that would be the ideal thing. That was exactly what I was looking for.
Because it was large enough that you didn't have to collect.
Yeah, it was big. And it said that it grows the size of it, gets to be several hundred pounds. So I called up Whitmore and told Whitmore that I thought I had found the thing I was looking for, and it grows in Mexico. He said, "Oh, well, the war is about ready to start." He said, "You don't want to go to Mexico." I said, "Yes, if but I don't have enough money. That's the reason I called you, to get a little more money." And he sent me the money down. So We collected plants in Texas. When we finished collecting in Texas, I went to Mexico, and I was pretty smart and cocky at that time. Going to Mexico, I asked there were no Americans on the train going to Mexico, because no one knew whether we were going to get into the war or not, and no one knew whether Mexico would be in on our side or not. And so the embassy and everyone was advising all Americans to stay out of Mexico at that time. Well, I asked the head porter on the train where a hotel near the Zocalo was, because the Zocalo I thought would be the ideal place. Well, he told me he gave me the name of a hotel, which I later found out from the American embassy that all of the German spies were staying. Well, I took a room there. It was a very nice hotel. I forget what the name of the hotel is now. I've been there many times.
Was that the Hotel Geneve?
No, it's not the Geneve. The embassy was right beside the Geneva, and the embassy told me the next time I come to Mexico to stay at the Geneva from then on, because they said the majority of their war workers were they had a lot of war workers there, and they had roughly 400 rooms at the Geneva, and about half of those were taken by workers of the that were working with the embassy. Mm-hmm. Well, I went over to the palace, And I didn't know who to go to. I went to the president's office, the president of Mexico. I had no letter to
her.
And so I was able to get into an inner office, and someone spoke English there. And they told me that you have to take a matter like this through the embassy. So I went to the American embassy. They told me where the American embassy was, and so I took a taxi up to the American embassy. American embassy told me that I would have to have permits to collect plants in Mexico to get them out, even for research, and said that that they were getting out of Mexico everyone that that didn't have business in Mexico at that time, because they didn't know how things were going to be. They said one thing that you can do, you can get inoculated for typhoid, because you'd be going down to a typhoid country if you go down there. And they said, come back in January. Said, we'll try to have the collecting permits, and we'll try to have someone to go with you, a botanist. I went down in January.
January of which year? 1940?
That would have been the January. When did we get into the war? 41.
41.
January
41?
January 42 is what
it is. Oh, right after Pearl Harbor.
Yes, it was after Pearl Harbor. See, Pearl Harbor came. I went on collecting plants. Then I went back to Arizona, and I went to California, and I happened to be on the train going from California to Los Angeles to San Francisco when it was announced over the loudspeaker that we were in war with Japan. But I went down in January, and the embassy hadn't done anything. They didn't expect me to come back. So they finally got a man who was a botanist with the university, with one of the universities in Mexico, and they thought that I would need a truck, because I told them that I wanted to collect some other plants. Well, we got a truck, and I assumed that the botanist was going to go with us on the truck. There'd be three of us on the truck. Well, I was staying at the Geneva Hotel, and the botanist came on a Monday, and he had his girlfriend. He had his girlfriend's mother, and he said that he couldn't speak English. So he had someone that could speak a little English. We got to Puebla, which was about 80 miles. That's all the further he would go the first day, because he was interested in getting plants. Then we went, maybe 40, 50 miles further the next day. I was only interested in Cabeza de Negro, and which he said he could get for me. Well, we stayed a couple of days there, and I found out that this botanist, the woman, we were staying in a hotel at just what was the name of it? I forget the name of the town. My mind gets so bad when I try to review something because of my age that I just forget. Anyway, it'll come to me in a few minutes. Well, anyway, we got to this town, and he collected quite a number of things that he would be interested in, that
were of no interest at all to me. So about Thursday or Friday, he came to me and he told me that some of the people out there found out that you were an American, and that they were against Americans, that I can't go any further with you. We have to go back to Mexico. We have to give up getting the plant. So we went back to Mexico. We had a little trouble with the truck going back, and so it took an extra day to get back. Tehuacan is the name of the town. So I went to the embassy, and the embassy told me, that was on a Monday, embassy told me that they couldn't do anything for me to get out of Mexico, to take the next train out of Mexico. Well, this fellow came around to the embassy. I wasn't there at the time. He came around and tried to blame his not completing the trip. He tried to blame it on me because of the fact that they had found out that I was an American, and it wasn't advisable to take Americans down in those days. Well, instead of taking the train back, I found out from the hotel where the bus was. They went to the station for the bus that went to the vicinity where this route was. I took the bus, and I had to change in Puebla. I took the bus in the night. Instead of taking the train, I took the bus, and I went to Puebla in the night. And I had to change there, and we got onto an old run-down bus that had pigs in the bottom, and the woman beside me had some chickens. I got to Orizaba about daylight. Mm-hmm. I checked into a hotel there, and I found out where there was a bus going to Cordoba. Orizaba was known for Orizaba is a big bottling place for beer. Mm-hmm. They make a very good beer there. So we got to I was on the bus. I had to stand up on this bus. It was one of these standing buses for local, just hauling workers back and forth between the two towns there, which were about, say, 15 miles apart. We came to a stream of water. And I asked the driver to get off. He didn't know what I wanted, but he suspected that I wanted to get off there. So I get off there, and there was a little store there. I went to the little store, and I finally got him to understand, got the fellow that kept the store. His name was Alberto Moreno. I got him to understand that I wanted some cabeza de negro. I kept saying cabeza de negro because that means negro head, and looked like a kinky head of a negro. Well, that is from the distance, because about one third of it grows out of the ground, the round part of it, and you can get some that are not deformed by tree trunks or things like that that look like the perfect head of a negro sticking out of the ground. Well, he told me to come back the next day. At least that's what I thought I understood. So I went back to my hotel. He wanted to know where I was staying. And all I could mention was Orizaba. I went back to, it was a little hotel. And I found out that there was a very good luxury hotel only about 2 miles away from where Alberto Moreno had his little store. And Alberto Moreno had a coffee drying place across the road from that. He dried coffee in the coffee collecting season, which I used quite a bit later on. So I went back the next day. And this local bus where we had to stand up on had quite a crowd on. He put them in bags and put them up on top of the bus. And we got to Orizaba, and they, by the time I got off of the bus, they had both disappeared. So a policeman came up to me and started speaking in Spanish. I didn't know any Spanish in those days. I know a little now, but I mean, I don't go hungry when I go down to the tropics or anything like that. But I understand that he wanted some money to give it back. All I had was I had a $10 note in my pocket, and I handed that to him, and he took that and he gave me one. And I understood that he could get me out of no more money, I told him. So I got the one, and I took it back to Mexico City. And I brought it back to Penn State, and I did my work on that, on half of it. I did the work all personally. I found out that would be a source of material for Sapperman. And I took the other part out to Park Davis, and I had three of my workers had been working for Park Davis. I wanted to show them the entire process, how to make progesterone from the material that we would get out, and also show them how to get the material out of this.
So, this raises one question I had, which was, where did all the money come from for all these travels around the Southwest? And
I just had to, Park Davis, the most money that Park Davis ever put here was $10,000. And I had to pay my graduate student. They got a small fellowship, something like $800 or something like that. I had to pay some of those, and my chemicals, glassware, things like that. I had to get out. And Whitmore would come to me. He said, "Do you need some more money?" Then I would chisel some out of him.
When did the relationship with Park Davis start?
About a year after that.
How did that develop?
Cam and I became very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
Cam was the director of research of Park Davis,
yeah.
And Cam would come here several times a year,
mm-hmm.
And he would stay for a few days here and to see what I was doing and things like that, but. Anything that I would want when I was out there, he would give me. That he didn't have to spend. But after I showed the process to my fellows, Cam and I went to the president, who was left here at that time. He was a medical doctor. And we wanted to set up in Mexico. Park Davis had just established a new packaging place in Mexico City. And I had been out to that. I knew what they had in Mexico. They had a lot of land, and the buildings were sufficient to see whether it could go into production. And all that I asked for $10,000 to put Park Davis into production in Mexico. And Lester here said that nothing could be done in Mexico. He knew that because of the fact that he was taken off of a boat at Acapulco with appendicitis, and he was put in a hospital there, and he got such rough treatment they thought he was going to die. And he said that they would not give anything. He said, "It's just a waste of money. Besides, you have established for us the production of progesterone from bull's urine. You've established it from the pregnant diol, which we get out of pregnancy urines here, and that is enough for it." He said, "We'll run a stable of bulls in here, just like we have a stable of horses." He said, "We'll get 1,000 if necessary, 1,000 bulls if necessary, and just collect the urine." But he said, "There's no use thinking of going to Mexico." He said, "It can't be done in the first place." Well, after I went to Mexico, I told Lester here, I'll have to look to someone that would be interested in going to Mexico if Park Davis is not interested in it. So I went to several pharmaceuticals. I went to Merck, and I went to SIBA, and I went to Oh, what is this? Mark of Sheba. Sharing plow?
Mm-hmm.
And none of them were interested in it. Because they thought that nothing could be done in Mexico. See, Mexico, there was no equipment, no glassware. There was some of this German glass in, but you didn't know if you heated something up in it, you didn't know whether it was going to break or not. Fortunately, they had some 5-gallon Pyrex bottles that they had for other purposes. So I got all of those that I could. And we distilled out of those Pyrex bottles because I could trust those. There was no chemistry. See, they didn't have a chemical society until, I think it was 1954 or somewhere around there, that they even established the chemical society in Mexico.
So you, when Park Davis turned you down, the other company turned you down, you went back down to Mexico?
I went to Mexico, and I was wondering how I could make contact. I went to the head of Salubridad. Salubridad is a health place of Mexico. They're tied in with the government. And the only answer that I could get, what was his name? Anyway, I forget what his name was. Anyway, finally, after talking to him quite a bit and going out to some of his party, he was running for some political thing, and he would take it with some girls that spoke English and some things like that. I don't know what it was all about, but anyway, I thought I'd made arrangements with him until he finally told me that you produce it at your expense and I'll sell it for you. So that was all that I could get out of Mexico. I was in the Hotel Geneve, and I was looking in their telephone book under laboratorios, and there was a laboratorios hormona. I thought, gosh, they must use hormones. They had the name of hormona. So I went out to see them, and there was a man that was in charge of the production there, was Dr. Lehman. His son became a chemist later on. His son was just a little boy, maybe 8 years old, when I first went to Mexico. Lehman, I talked to Lehman, and Lehman said, "What is your name?" So I told him again what my name was. He said, "Excuse me a little." He went back, and he came back with a Journal of the American Chemical Society. He said, "I thought I recognized your name." And I told him that the product that I was interested in working on looked like potato chips, that it would be chopped up from a product that grew in the tropics and sun-dried, and then that would be ground up and extracted with alcohol. He said it sounds very interesting, but the man that owns Hormona is in New York at the present time. He asked me whether I could stay over a day or so. So I told him yes, I could stay over if there was some possibility of getting the funds for this. That was Sanlo. Mm-hmm. Lehman and Sanlo and I had a talk the next night. But Sanlo, I had some of these chips with me that I had brought back from Marino. He was drying some for me. Samuel said that he would be very interested. He said that only hormones that they were modeling were they had bought some crude stuff from Germany, and they were putting it up in ampoules at that time, but only in minute amounts. But he said that he would be very interested in establishing something. So we worked out that we would form a new company. And that I would eventually, if I could get the products to go into production, I would eventually come to Mexico to produce. So I went to Mexico several times during that year, and I went out to see Lehman, and I told Lehman that during the year I wanted to be sure that I could produce this. And during the year I had worked up around 10 tons of root with Moreno, and I sun-dried it, and we got out roughly two tons of root, which he brought up to Mexico, and I made arrangements for an extraction here in Mexico with alcohol. I could never find that the place that I had that extracted. I don't know whether it was torn down or not. I have some pictures at home of the place, but it wasn't so far from Guadalupe. I knew a fellow in New York City that I had become very friendly with. He was selling some hormones, and he had gotten into trouble with SIBA over a patent. And I went, it was the only time that I ever went for patent purposes, that is, in court. I went to Washington to try to tell them in court that this man should have the patent and didn't belong to SIBA. Well, that's how I became acquainted with him. So I asked him whether he had a laboratory. He told me he had a laboratory at that time, and I stayed about. I think it was one night that I stayed in Washington. I asked him then after we were through whether he would be interested in my producing some progesterone from some material that I would get from Mexico. I told him that I would give him one third of the material. And he just jumped at me. He said, "Do you know how much this progesterone is selling for now?" At that time, it was roughly $1,000 a gram because there was no progesterone available. And he wanted to know how much I thought I would get out. I told him I thought I'd get maybe 3 kilos, get him a kilo if he would let me work it in his laboratory and furnish the material that I would need. I would need acetic anhydride and some other things like that. He said, "Oh yes, come in." So I worked there, and I got the 2 kilos, a little bit over 2 kilos that I had for myself. So I went to Lane. When I was right ready to come out, come back to the States, I went out to Hormona to see whether they had what the status was on the equipment that Lehman was getting for me. Well, it ended up by me telling Lehman that I had produced, had in my hands in the States here, 2 kilos of, a little over 2 kilos of progesterone. Well, Samuel was out of town at that time. So Lehman told Samuel when he came back that I had a couple kilos of progesterone, which was an unheard of amount of progesterone at that time. I came back to Penn State. Fortunately, I was able to get on a plane. Sometimes I could get on a plane, other times I had to take the train, because they had just these little planes at that time, and sometimes there'd be all embassy people taking the plane, and then even though you were reserved, you were kicked off and you had to take the train back. But fortunately, I got the plane back to Washington and came back on the train from Washington. Well, after I got here, Sumner wanted to know whether I still had that 2 kilos of progesterone, whether I could meet him in New York. So I met him in New York. We went to he took me to the Waldorf Astoria for dinner and all that kind of crap to butter me up. He wanted to know whether we could work out something that Hormona could sell this product. Well, we worked out the possibility that we had agreed to establish a new company to produce hormones in Mexico. And the company was going to be set up for 500,000 pesos. The peso at that time was, the value of the peso was around 21 cents at that time. My share of that would have been around $41,000, because I was to get 40% of this new company that was to be set up. He said, "All right, you give me the progesterone." He said that he had an office in New York, and the man that was running the office was named Huben. He wanted to know where the progesterone was. I told him that it wasn't in New York. He said, "Can you bring it back to New York and give it to Huben?" Well, I gave it to a friend of mine to deliver to Huben. And the arrangement was that my share of this new company, which was going to be established, which was going to be Syntex, would be paid for in full out of the funds that we would get for that. He said that he would establish a price of $80 a gram, because we didn't know what to establish it for. $80 a gram, which would have been $160,000 for the 2 kilos. And he said that we made the arrangement then that my share of this new company would be paid for in full, and any remainder would be turned over as profit for this company. The remainder of the money would be sold as profit for this company. The rest of the $160,000 would go as profit, and it would be split. He would get 52%, Lehman would get 8%, and I would get 40%. Never got it. That was the end of it. After a year and 4 months, he kept telling me that there's no profit, but we get profit when we split it, and things like that. And I kept asking him for the money, for the accounting of this new company which we set up as Syntex. And he kept putting me off and things like that. And so I decided to set up my own company and leave Syntex, because I decided I wasn't going to get anything. But he gave me enough money to live on and to send back to my wife. My wife had come back to State College, and she was living and educating my 2 sons, because we decided that Mexico wasn't a place at that time to educate our sons, because she was in Mexico the summer before, and we sent the younger son to school down there, but he just considered it a big joke, because they went to school in the summertime, and he thought that should be his vacation. He was, I think, 8 years old then.
Well, that's so... How, you were living there for 16 months by yourself while they were back in?
I would come back occasionally.
Did you ever bring a lawyer in, or try to adjudicate this?
Yes, I had a lawyer. You see, I set up a company called Mechanical Methods at Texcoco, and I needed a lawyer. I got a French lawyer who the American Embassy recommended that I get. He spoke English perfectly and everything like that. And he set up the company of Botanica Banks. And he met with Samo and with Samo's lawyer several times. He had a meeting with Samo once, which is unusual for a lawyer to meet with a man that on the other side. That, and Samo told him what he would settle for. Samo told him that he would settle for. I had a paper from Samo that was written that that I was to have 40% of the new company that was to be set up, and I kept that in a safe deposit box in a bank in Mexico. Well, Samo told him I had been having quite a bit of trouble. One the man that was collecting. Barbasco for me. I went down with him. He was having a lot of trouble collecting. We went someplace, and he said that he pointed out. We went to a small village, and he pointed out a man. He said that's the man that's been giving me trouble. My man was killed that night. Hmm. He died. He died in Orizaba.
That year, of the first year that I was producing in Mexico, I was producing progesterone. I had two night watchmen on, and I gave my lawyer got me two guns, pistols. One was a Smith & Wesson, and another was a well-known pistol. Well. They would go out for their evening meal, and one would stay at the place while the other would go out. They slept and they would alternate on sleeping. Well, the one went out and like a Mexican was, he carried his pistol with him. I had given orders that they weren't to take the pistol out of the place, and he was grabbed outside of the door, and he was shot with his own pistol through the leg. So, my lawyer knew all of these things that were happening, and so my lawyer asked Samlo, and I met with Samlo once myself, and we had dinner one night at a good restaurant. He paid for us.
That's nice of him.
So that's all I got out. He wanted me to come back and give him the process, and it's before Rosencrantz came with. Oh. By the way, this week I showed Dean Wartick something that I get this from Syntex, which was this company that was set up, and it's only given to employees of Syntex. If you're my son has a few shares of Syntex stock, and he can't get this, so I have to get it. But anyway, in here. It gives the story of the starting of Syntex, and this is Rosencrantz that took it over, and here is about my coming, and this was the old Hormona this top wasn't on there when I went, but this is I had two laboratories here. The entrance was between the two laboratories, and then I had the extractors on down further. Hmm. But this was the section that I set up here. In about 5 months after the time. But this apparently was taken over because the whole thing now was called Syntex. And with Shipley that wrote this article for Stern Magazine, I took him and the man that was going to write for the movie part. I took them around and showed them this. But this is all taken down now. This front part here now. Yeah. There's copper shops and things like that that are in here. Each one, just little shops. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not used for hormone pumping. But this is where I was using. And here's Rosencrantz, and he tells it here a little about his copy then. Yeah.
Did you ever meet Rosencrantz in those early days?
No, I never met. Once when I was getting an award for something.
Was that in 1969? When I had
disappeared, and Roger Adams, he used to be head of the American Chemical Society, all back I think before I went to Mexico even, and I had dinner with him several times while he was in Mexico. He died shortly after that. He wanted me to come out to Illinois to visit him. But I told him that I didn't. But he told me at the dinner that we had. We had dinner out at Lehman's, Young Lehman's. Mm-hmm. And he told me at the dinner out there that he and some others were fully convinced that they were going to a memorial that was being set up by this society that was meeting there for me, and he thought that I was dead, you see, because the reports were that I was dead, that I had disappeared. And he thought that this was to be the memorial until Lehman gave a speech, and then I walked down. He said that was a great surprise to everybody.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I was just reviewing Maisel's book, The Hormone Quest. You know, it came out in 1965.
Uh-huh.
And in that book, he has some statements that, you know, nobody knows if you were alive or dead. And
uh-huh.
Obviously you knew where you were.
Well, I was working on silver then.
Yeah. Well, that was. Let me ask you a couple of things about that in a minute. But in 1944, then you set up Botanica Mex. Left Syntex, set up Botanica Mex.
That would have been 1945.
1945. So, and you told me about the trouble you were having with Botanica Mex. So at that point, that is, you know, the people attacking your workers and mm-hmm. other things. What was the outcome of all of that then? You said that you sold, you changed the name.
I sold it to two other hard guys. Now Sandro, he doesn't have a doctor's degree any more than I have. He gave it to himself.
Mm-hmm.
He's a lawyer,
mm-hmm.
and lawyers don't have doctor's degrees. But to sell his product, why he calls himself Dr. Sabo. He did. He's dead now.
Mm-hmm.
He died in France. Well, the people that Sabo was working for, getting Richter, Sandro was working for Gedeon Richter for a while, and all of a sudden Gedeon Richter found out that there was a laboratory called Laboratorios Hormona, which was selling similar products to the things that they were interested in selling, only it had a label on Hormona, and Sandro was working for Gedeon Richter at that time. Now this is Richter's story that I got from them. And he would take these samples, give to his wife would ampoule them and distribute them around. And that's how Hormona got started. That's their story to me. Well, these were Hungarians that had Gedeon Richter that took over Botanica Mex, and then called it, started operating as Hormasynth.
Mm-hmm. Had you taken out Mexican patents on your processes?
I took no patents out. I left everything open to the public.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mr. Richter, the son of Gedeon Richter, they came from Budapest originally, and during the war, they went to Turkey. Young Mr. Richter, I never asked what, but I had dinner with young Mr. Richter in in New York a few times when he was in New York. I met him in Mexico. He stayed at the Geneve Hotel where I was staying, and apparently their Turkish project was pretty good. But anyway, Winkler, who was running Gedeon Richter in Mexico, was the nephew of the original Gedeon Richter. Well, at the start of the war, Richter knew that they would have difficulty in Mexico. They didn't know how things were going to come out in Mexico. So he got his nephew to talk over the thing with him, and they decided that he would give him a power of attorney for everything in Mexico. Well, young Mr. Richter then came to Mexico to find out what the situation was there after the war was over. And he stayed for a few months there, asking questions, going out to and he found out that they had taken over completely the thing. It was Winkler, Kish, and Rivers had taken over, because the old Mr. Richter had given them a power of attorney. And he said to me, never give a power of attorney to anybody because of the fact that he said that I'm not getting anything out of it. Mm. And he told me that that was the reason he asked me to come to New York. Mm. Then, after I had become affiliated with them. Mm-hmm. They came, the three of them, came out to look over the equipment that my friend had set up in Texcoco to operate, to make progesterone. We made roughly 30 kilos or something like that during the year. We made some dehydroisohydrosterone, which are made by the Beckman rearrangement there. So things got so bad that my friend had put up all the funds necessary for setting this up at Texcoco, because I didn't have any money to begin with. They had beat me out of what I was supposed to have with Sente. This was the fellow that I went to. They got the first kilo of progesterone, knew that I could make progesterone.
What was his name?
His name was Eric. He's dead now. Hmm. He died of a heart attack a number of years ago. Well, let's see, I forgot what I was saying.
Oh, you were telling me that they had come down after Gedeon Richter had come down after they'd bought Vitamix.
Oh, the arrangement was, when I went with Gedeon Richter, that they would get someone to come in, and I would they would get a good chemist to come in, and I would show them the process of making progesterone. Progesterone was the only thing that they were interested in, because they said that they wanted to go against Somlo, because they had it in for Somlo.
Because he'd also,
yeah,
I think he'd also taken them as well.
Well, anyway, they want to know whether I had any suggestions. There's a fellow that worked for Jacobs at Rockefeller Institute that worked on sarsaparilla, and he knew a little about that. And not only that, but when he left the Rockefeller Institute, he went to Zurich, and he worked with what's his name?
Ruzicka?
He worked with Ruzicka. Mm-hmm. When he came back and the war started, well, to begin, he came back to the Rockefeller Institute, and he worked with Bergman for a while. Mm-hmm. Bergman was a refugee from Germany. It was a very good man, and he worked on the floor below where I was. So I was pretty well acquainted with this. I knew his girlfriend and so on like that. And so I got in touch with him because he had been with Upjohn for a while, and then he went with the government.
What was his name?
Augustus was his name. I got in touch with him and I asked whether he would be interested in a project in Mexico. And he said that he would. He came down, and I showed him how to make progesterone. I met with the girls that I had a few of the girls that were trained with me at Centex. They went to be at Botanica Bex, and then I went to getting Richter to Hormacep with the same girls. Well, I asked him whether he knew the process, and he said yes, he thinks he could handle it all right. This was at the end around the 1st of June.
In 45, 46?
40. Let me see once. 45. It was probably 46. I was back home with my family here in State College, and I stayed here. At the end of about 2 months, I got phone calls and word from Winkler, who was head of this place, that they didn't have a gram of progesterone. That something happened to this fellow who was unable to make it for them. And so I went back. Well, it so happened that this fellow, he had a hobby of learning Spanish, and he spoke Spanish fluently. Some of the girls that were working for me said that he spoke Spanish fluently, and he knew enough Spanish to call in Pigeon Brain whenever anything went wrong. So they saw to it that he got nothing. Well, Winkler told me that they couldn't have him, and they asked me whether I could come back with them until they could get on their feet and get someone else. Well, they got a Polish fella, Nuremberski. Well, Somnol had him put in jail after he was there for a short time, and the same thing happened with other people until I was there off and on for about roughly 3 years.
How did
Somnol
manage to get them put in jail?
Well, he claimed that he had no working permit to come to Mexico to work, and he had him put in jail. Then he finally left. He had his wife there. He was Polish, Nuremberski.
So you had to keep coming back to make the progesterone for Homer's.
Yeah. I decided that I had enough. The beginning of 49, and so I went to Winkler and I told him that I was finished, that I wasn't trying to work anymore. So they finally sold it to Smith, Kline, and French, mm-hmm. which changed the name, and then Smith, Kline, and French, they sold it, I don't know when they sold it to Organon, probably in the 60s or somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had, in the last couple of years you were in Mexico, you kept publishing on, in JAX, on the steroidal sabadenins and other things with... I noticed one of the authors was Josefina Lopez.
Yeah.
She one of the girls who had worked at
Centex? She was with me at Centex. Mm-hmm. The people that she went from her parents. She was a Tawana Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And she went with to some people that were with an oil firm in Mexico. Gosh, what was their name? Anyway, she learned English by being with them. Then when the war started, she was in England. These people had to leave Mexico, and they went back to England, and they put her in a school in England. Then they sent her to study music in Switzerland, but she spoke English perfectly. And she was looking for a job, and I ran into her, and I hired her for Syntex. She's the only person of Syntex that spoke English, and she stayed with me all the time. And she, I saw her, about 8 years ago. See, I hadn't been to Mexico for about 8 years because my wife was got in bad condition; she couldn't travel anymore, and I saw. But anyway, she was married to a Norwegian sea captain who became a United States citizen.
Hmm. Did she stay in chemistry, or did she?
No. After when I left, she left too.
Hmm. And also,
she got married very shortly after that. She knew that she met this sea captain. She met him in Acapulco.
Was that one of the pictures that we were going to run in your article when it comes out in Shock News is a picture of you with a group of women at Syntex, and she must be in that picture.
She's in that picture, yes.
Well, I wish I had it here so we could see the show.
I had that picture the other day to bring out, and I didn't bring it out.
Yeah. Oh, well, we'll have to, maybe I could send you a copy and you could say who the people are, and that would be very helpful. Another major paper that appeared in that last few years that you were still active in with Botanicamex was the, let's see, I have it here. This was the review paper, or not a review paper, the summary paper of all your work on the steroidal cephagenin.
Is that the layman?
No, this is the one with...
This is
1947.
Yeah, that's the real long one.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, about 40 pages or something like that.
Yeah. Were you in Penn State when this was being done, or in Mexico?
No, I was here when the whole thing was done.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Whitmore, and I told Whitmore that I had about a dozen papers or more that needed to be written up. But I was suggesting that it all be put in one paper.
Mm-hmm.
And Whitmore thought it would be a good idea. So he said, which one of your... of the men that are working for you, do you want to write it? He mentioned that some of them were going to be here for a year, so Wagner was one. And Wagner got it in shape, and he sent me a copy several times, and it was published then. That is, the total work combined. And we also got in touch with Dr. Lamb, and Dr. Lamb was the editor of the Journal of American Chemical Society, and Lamb thought it would be a good idea to publish it all together.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting paper.
Mm-hmm.
And
Wagner stayed here. Old Schaefer went with Seba. Whitbecker, I think, went with DuPont. Goldsmith was with was with Merck, and then later on he went with. I think he went with to the University of Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And Roop, I think, went with the Mellon Institute in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
He went, at least Roop went to Pittsburgh. So there was only Wagner was the only one that was left.
Mm-hmm.
All Schaefer's dead now.
Mm. Yeah, I noticed that a number of your PhDs and postdocs went to companies like Upjohn and Merck and Park Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were really acting as a center for training people in the steroidal chemistry that became important to a large number of pharmaceutical companies in that period.
You see, the chemistry of steroids fit in quite well with anything that they wanted to do in organic chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Because in steroids, eventually, we used all of the chemical processes that we would use in that were used in for ordinary chemical work. Now, for instance, like this Beckmann rearrangement, who would have thought that could be used in steroid work? Yet I got this fellow to come up from University of Virginia, who was experienced in that for his doctor's degree, to work a year here on it, to show us the techniques that were used and anything that would be of use to us.
How?
And yet it's used commercially the present day. It's used an awful lot.
Well, that is that's an interesting point, because also Carl Gerassi, 20 years ago, published a book called Steroid Reactions, I believe the title is. And he makes the argument there that the same point that you just said, that sterols really provide a useful laboratory for teaching organic synthesis, because you can use all the basic techniques.
Yes, because...
And it just seems to be much more complicated because the molecule's backbone is so much larger, but in fact the active sites are...
And you can do it with such small amounts, too.
Yeah.
Because you don't need... For instance, if something comes out in oil, you'll need several cc's of that. Mm-hmm. Whereas here you can work with milligrams or something of that nature.
Yeah. How did you analyze what techniques did you use to analyze the final products that you got? This was before things like IR and other instrumental methods.
I used an analyst that Jacobs was using at the Rockefeller Institute, but he would do this at his home.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. I had too many for him. And Fleming, Dr. Fleming, started studying microanalysis. And he set up to run microanalysis here so that I had too many for Riggs was the name of the fellow over in New York, and Fleming here. So some of them were sent out to Washington.
So those were, you would have to have them, those were just, what, elemental analyses of?
Just for, they would work on all maybe 4 milligrams or something like that. Here, I don't know if you've seen this in Chemical Engineering News, here's when I'm getting the last award, which I went to Mexico for, when American Chemical Society and Mexican Chemical Society and Canadian met in Mexico.
Okay.
I guess this was a he gave a talk, one of the talks. He was one of the vice presidents of Syntex, and he was leaving at the end of that year. He had his wife there. They were applauding my getting here is where oh th- this this is Bailey from the University of Maryland. He was head of the Chemical Society at that time. And I think the fellow with glasses on was president of the Mexican Chemical Society.
Mm-hmm.
With glasses.
Mm-hmm.
One of these is president of the Mexican Chemical Society, and other is president of the Canadian. These were the three presidents there. And I don't know which is... I know Bailey.
Yeah. Well, it's appropriate to have Bailey there since he's from the University of Maryland too. No, I hadn't seen that picture. That's very interesting. This must have been part of the entertainment.
Yeah, this is some of the entertainment that they have there. Yeah.
Let me just ask you a couple of final questions about when in 1949 you said a few minutes ago that you just decided that. You know, with all the running back and forth between Penn State and Mexico, and I gather your family was still in State College.
They stayed in State College all of that time. And as a matter of fact, my sons came to Mexico occasionally, but they would come only for a day or two, and they would have to get back to school here. They would get a job in the summer and things like that. You see.
So in 1949,
when you decided to leave, just to quit Hormosynth and leave chemistry, what, you know, did you miss chemical research since you've been
no.
so active at it?
No. I was on some classified work then with the United States and in Mexico jointly, and I was on that for part time for a number of years, and about 56, I met a woman on the street. She had two big dogs, and I had met her before. She had a shop which she sold leather goods in. And she had moved around right back of the Geneva Hotel, about a half block one way and a half block the other way. So it would be about a block to walk around to her place. And she told me that she was still selling leather goods. As a matter of fact, the briefcase that I brought in here today, I bought from her about 35 years ago. And she said that her father, who was a Frenchman, who worked in Paris before, now this girl was married to a Mexican, and she opened up a leather shop in addition to the husband's salary, that she wanted to make some money on the side. She said that her father had retired from Paris, and he had a shop right across from the American Embassy in Paris, and she said she would like for me to meet him. So I told her that I would drop around there sometime, and he was interested in silver, and he had this silver shop right across from the American Embassy in Paris, and he originally, as a boy, he worked with Fabergé in Russia. To make Fabergé was making these eggs. You see, they have some at the Metropolitan Museum, but they're mainly in Paris. But he was forced to leave in 1916. He left Russia. Fabergé went to Switzerland, and this girl's father went to Paris. And she would only see him occasionally when she would go to Paris, because he was busy on that shop, but he had given up completely, and he had come to Mexico, and that he was selling in his shop a few things that he would buy as he would call it secondhand silver, that is like the bridge made and things like that. Well, I went in to see him, and I had gone several times. I had gone to the library at the Vatican in my work, and I had become familiar with one of the, I guess you would call him a bishop, there that was in charge of things, and we talked quite a bit about various things, and he was interested. He wanted to know whether I had ever been to the Louvre, and I had been to the Louvre several times. And he said, when you go in there, they keep in the basement locked up some of their valuable things. See if you can't go down to see those. He said that he was particularly interested in a vase which they had, which they kept locked up, and this vase came from Turkey, and it was supposed to be from the burial place of one of Nebuchadnezzar's generals. So he was quite interested in the vase. And a French woman found a Turkish man that was doing some he was doing some fishing on the side, but he came to her and wanted to know whether she wanted to buy some gold that he had melted down. And she told him right away that she knew that this came from melting down something that he got from a grave, that he was a grave robber. And that if he would give her the original, any original pieces that he had, she would buy that and the gold at the regular price of the selling price of gold from it. So he couldn't turn this down. And this was one of the vases that he said that he wished that I would take a look at. Well, he'd been so helpful to me that the next time I went to Mexico, oh, there's another thing that I saw at the Louvre that they showed me. And this was a drinking cup about a little bit bigger than this that was made for Anne of Austria. And this was made of pure gold, too. And it's one of another of the things that they keep locked up. Well, I got pictures and the size and the weight and everything of these two items. I took them to this girl's father in Mexico and asked him whether they could be made. And he said, "Well, at your expense." He always said, "At your expense, everything." I told him I'd like for these to be made in silver. I told him, and then I plated with gold. Well, this a plain vase from there was a plain vase from Turkey. It was so good. I considered it as far as I knew a perfect reproduction. And I asked him what the price of it was. He told me the price, which was very cheap. I asked him whether he could make some more of those. So I wanted to give one to each of my sons, and I told him one I wanted in silver to keep for myself. I kept the one in silver for myself, and I had three of them gilded, and the one I took to this bishop at the Vatican Library, which had been doing the work for me. And he was very pleased to get that. But I've given all of my silver to my two sons. Mm-hmm. Because I want to get rid of it, not to be bothered with after I die. I don't know what they're charging for.
So that's how you got started in mm-hmm. silver reproduction.
So he made these two pieces for me. Then I asked him whether there were any other silversmiths in Mexico that he would recommend that could be trained into the Rococo. The Rococo is extremely hard because you know it has so many twirls and twists and things like that on it, and it costs many more times than the plain silver. For instance. One of the best workers on Rococo was Paul LaMarie. His parents were Frenchmen, but he was born. They took him to Holland, and he was born in Holland, and he then went to England with his parents, and he became a silversmith. But he was interested in making the Rococo. But he couldn't find anyone in England that wanted to put the amount of money in the Rococo that it would cost them. They all wanted plain things because they considered this as a place to put their money. Mm-hmm. So he only made a few pieces of the real Rococo. One of the pieces, I was at the Ashbolian Museum at Oxford University once. And I was talking to the girl in charge of silver there, and I was looking at a particular piece that I had a piece of Paul LaMarie's that was listed as being at the Ashmolean Museum. Well, she asked me whether I could come to dinner with the one that was in, ahead of her. So I went to dinner and we talked about silver the whole time. Well, it came out, they wanted to know whether I had ever visited this shop on Regent Street, which was originally Paul and Marie's shop, until it was taken over by Garrick, I think Garrick is the name of it. I told her, no, I had never been in there. So I went in this shop. I was heading for London. My wife was with me at that time, and she had never seen Churchill's place and things like that. So while I went to the Ashbury Museum, she went out on the regular tour, you see. I pulled that quite a number of times on her. Well, anyway, I walked in this shop, and they had a table in the back. And there was a big sign on it. It was about the size of this table. There was a big sign right in the middle, used silver. So I asked one of the clerks there, "Is this silver for sale?" They said, "Yes. Are you interested in it?" Sitting on right in the center was the piece that I was looking for, and it was made in 1902, and it was sold as used silver. It's the only Rococo, and the Rococo was made by a man who was the silversmith for Queen Victoria in 1902.
Well, that was a lucky find, wasn't it?
And I then asked them for it. They wanted to buy it back from me.
Mm-hmm.
Guards is the name of it. I gave the piece to my son, but I have a statement from them.
Well, that's very interesting. So how long were you active at collecting and commissioning silver pieces?
Well, that's the only piece that someone else made. That I bought the piece, because I was actually going to have my silversmith work on it.
Mm-hmm. And you found the original.
It was a reproduction. Mm-hmm. and he had this silversmith. He was the head of the silversmith of Paula Marie's shop.
Hmm.
As his hobby, he would reproduce some of Paula Marie's work. That is, as his hobby in the night.
Hmm.
And sell it to some of the lords or someone that would come in to buy it. But the guards told me that they took it off of the hands of one of the estates there.
Yeah.
They said it never had been used.
Hmm. That's interesting. So during those years, were you living mainly in Mexico or still in State College?
I was in... No, not that. I was in Mexico, I was in State College, and I was in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Oh. The son of this woman that had this the leather shop, he then became interested in silver, and he's taken over this shop. And the workers that I had on Rococo, they either quit or died or something like that. But he's made a few before they quit or died. I left him in 1970, and this is. I see him occasionally when I go to Mexico, and this Leite is his name, and there is a small letter that I thought I was going to Mexico again, but he told me that Tani now is one of the six leading producers of silver in the Western world.
Hmm.
And they sell quite a lot of their products are sold to Tiffany's. And they have two shops that are set up here in the States, and they have, oh, I think 8 or 10 shops in Mexico, different places in Mexico.
Hmm.
Well, the Rococo, here are a few pieces of Rococo that I found those. The original of that is the Cardinal of... you see, there's only, maybe 20 pieces of the best worker on Rococo that France has ever had that are in existence at the present time. Because Madame Pompadour needed money to fight the British, and she ordered all silver melted down.
Mm.
And there's a few pieces that escaped being melted. A few pieces that went to Portugal and a few that went to the brother of the king, mm-hmm. the Duke of Orleans. Now that's another one of his. That's a soup ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But now that's in the Louvre. Now this is unusual. This is the original of that is a fruit ball. It's oval in shape,
mm-hmm.
and John Wayne was making some movies in Mexico, and he was out to the house of the ambassador, and he admired some of the silver that she had, and he asked where she got this silver, and she said that she got it at Tony's shop, the shop that I was working in. So he came in, and a piece that I didn't like, that I wanted him to make again, I had it for sale. That's how I got the money for making this silver, because if I didn't like something, why, I sold it, and the price that he paid for that was around $4,000. But now this is quite a better to me because of the fact that the original exists, and I found a painting with a number of Germain's pieces in. And this is one of the pieces that's in there, so that I could get the size of the pieces, of the other pieces that didn't exist, from the size of this piece.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So, but now, the last piece that Tony had, one of my workers, when he was going to quit, they wanted this piece for show purposes in there, and I asked Vilner how much he was going to put on the price for that. He said if anyone wants to pay $40,000, they could get it. So I don't know what price they're having on it. The original is gilded. Now my son has the one that I like.
Yeah.
One of my sons.
Yeah,
but now this this there's a right at the corners here is men's heads. You can't see, but that's artichokes at the top,
mm-hmm.
and this piece doesn't exist. This piece was in one of the paintings.
Oh. And so you had someone make it.
And I had my men work on that. Now these are not salt shakers. They're sugar shakers, and they're about a foot high. And these are in gilt, and the originals they don't exist. And they were in one of the paintings that I got, and. See, these are goat's legs at the bottom there, and this is the same painting with two spice boxes. Now these are divided in the middle there. You put pepper in the one side and salt in the other side, and I had a pair of those made. Now this is the work of one of the Englishmen, and the original of this. I was surprised where I would get that. The original of that was bought by the Untermeyer estate in Yonkers, New York, and it's in Yonkers, New York. Out at we used to live close to the Untermeyer estate, and I knew of it quite well. And I have made one of these for each of my. I have two sons, and I made one for each of the sons. And you can see this. First, the silversmith asked me how you see. I had down there a full time artist that was working for me for the time that I was working there. I had about a half time wood carver, because all of these were the pieces were carved in wood that were molded, and then they had to fit together from his carving. But they were wondering how. They see this inside had chiseling on it, just the same as the outside here, and how are we going to do that? Well, you make two bowls, and you solder the two together.
Oh, I see.
So it was so simple. But anyway, now here, this shows me with the spice boxes and this, and here is a. This is a tea kettle which is in the Louvre at the present time, but it was made from the Lord Mayor of London's daughter, Germain made it, and while they were fighting England.
Hmm.
Now here is this piece here you see, and this. I only have one of these, but I have a pair of these. These are wine corners. You see, these are dog's heads on the side here, cocker spaniels.
Oh, that looks interesting.
And the first one of these that I made, the president of Mexico's wife used to come to the shop every once in a while to see what was going on there. This is a room which they cleared out in the back there, because the leather shop, eventually they gave up the leather shop completely. And here there was a whole wall here of things which I had, which I eventually brought home then. But anyway, she wanted to know whether she could have this to take to her home to show to some friends, the first one that I made of these. I told her sure she could take it up, but she never brought it back. And so I had the Leites, the man that had the shop here, Pedro Leites, call her up about it, because I didn't want to lose the piece. So she wanted to know whether it could be partially gilded, that she'd like to have it. Do you know who they gave it to? They gave it to Nixon.
Really?
That was the president of Mexico that was given to Nixon. And so then I made the silversmiths that I had trained in into this work to make one for each of my boys.
Hmm. Yes.
So that I have two. Now here I quit. I quit everything all of a sudden. That's the letter. This is one of Thomas Germain. Worked on Rococo, and his son then worked for the King of Portugal on Rococo, because he couldn't make it in France, because it was all nationalized. And this is from one of the paintings of Germain's work, and this is what I was going to work on when I quit.
Oh, that would have been something.
Well. The boys could have done it, and I was planning on making two. Now when I quit, I told them not to publish anything because of the fact that I didn't want it known that I was living in the Geneve Hotel. I lived for 20 years. I lived in the Geneve Hotel and I knew the manager quite well. He was a Canadian manager and owner. He and his wife quite well, and they gave eventually their son-in-law took it over. And now at the present time, one of these firms in the United States bought it from the son-in-law. But anyway, they published this article.
Uh-huh.
And this is the boy, and I'm sitting beside the boy. Here I am. These two here. I've showed you the picture here.
Right. That one, yeah.
Here, yeah. And I showed you Paul and Marie's picture here.
Yeah.
But he's running the shop now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'd like to read that a little later. Brush off my Spanish, I said. And when you
here is this mm-hmm. this piece here.
So when you left, and this was in late 1969,
I left around 1970, and because of the fact that they published this, and everyone found out that I was still alive, I gave up silver,
uh-huh.
And then. I wanted to work on some of the designs which I had,
mm-hmm.
And they weren't interested. They were only interested in this Rococo silver.
Mm-hmm.
So I was over in a place where Mexicans come to sell their. Wares on their art wares on Sunday. They have paintings. They have various other things. There was an Aztec Indian there, and he had made of brass copies made of brass, and then they were stuck onto wood with thumbtacks sealed onto the brass, and then stuck onto wood of like the Virgin of Guadalupe and some other things like that. This fellow, I asked him where he was working, and he said he was working for the government, and that he was working with a department that was interested in making money, and that he was doing this on the sideline. I asked him whether he would be interested in making some Maya pieces, and similar to what he had. And he asked me about what I would be interested in, and whether I could get pictures of them and bring them in the next Sunday to him there, that he would be there. He's there every Sunday. I told him yes, I could. So I brought him a picture of a Maya head that I got this from a publication that was taken from a Maya at Palenque. And he asked me whether I would come back in a few weeks. I went back in a few weeks. He had this on a block about a foot square, and it was painted in color. And I asked him how he painted. He said a girlfriend of his did the painting. And I asked him whether he could do some more. Well, it got so that I spent 5 years with him. And I went to him once when I was in Mexico. I would be the first, I would always go on a Sunday to meet him. And I asked him what he had for me. Well, he said the Mexicans wanted to know whether he could put on an exhibit in Colombia, in South America, of work that was done in Mexico, of some of these plaques. And he wanted to know whether he could send a couple of these plaques, a few of them, to Mexico for the exhibit.